You're the Huddle Show. Comes right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is a date that people dread coming. It's April 15th, tax day. It's the 105th day of the year. And it's World Art Day. International Micro Volunteering Day. National Laundry Day. National Rubber Eraser Day. National Glazed Spiral Ham Day. Purple Up Day. Titanic Remembrance Day. National Anime Day. National ASL Day. That's American Sign Language Day. National That Sucks Day. National Take a Wild Guess Day. Especially prevalent in Congress. Discover National Parks Fortnight. Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival is going on. Goes on to the 21st. Started on the 12th. Parkinson Awareness Week. Animal Cruelty and Human Violence Awareness Week. National Week of Conversation. FOP Awareness Month. Famous people born on this date, Emma Watson, and whether you like him or not, Seth Rogen. April is also International Guitar Month. Step up for 30 for Bowel Cancer Month. Scottish American Heritage Month. Global Volunteer Month. National Alcohol Awareness Month. National Soy Foods Month. National Food Month. National Month of Hope. National Soft Pretzel Month. Animal Cruelty Prevention Month. National Volunteer Month. Sexual Assault Awareness Month. National Kite Month. National Garden Month. National Poetry Month. Autism Acceptance Month. National Pickleball Month. Limb Loss and Limb Difference Awareness Month. Stress Awareness Month. National Jazz Appreciation Month. Poetic Earth Month. National Couple Appreciation Month. Adoptive Ferret Month. Straw Hat Month. Month in a Military Child. Active Dog Month. Summer Tire Changeover Month. National Decorating Month. And Parkinson Awareness Month. Well, in 769 A.D., the Lateran Council ends by condemning the Council of Herrera and anathematizing its iconoclastic rulings. In 1071, Bari, the last Byzantine possession of southern Italy, is surrendered to Robert Guiscard. 1450, Battle of Formigny. Towards the end of the Hundred Years' War, the French attack and nearly annihilate English forces, ending English domination in northern France. 1632, Battle of Rennes. The Swedes under Gustavus Adolphus defeat the Holy Roman Empire during the Thirty Years' War. 1642, Irish Confederation War, Confederate Wars. A Confederate Irish militia is routed in the Battle of Kilrush when it attempts to halt the progress of a royalist army. 1715, the Pocotaligo Massacre triggers the start of the Yamasee War in colonial South Carolina. If you've never heard of the Pocotaligo Massacre, when the warnings about a possible Ochizi Creek uprising reached the South Carolina government, they reacted, sent a party to the main upper Yamasee town of Pocotaligo, that's near Yamasee, South Carolina. They hoped to obtain Yamasee assistance in arranging an emergency summit with the Ochizi Creek leaders. But the delegation, its visit to Pocotaligo triggered the start of the war. They visited Pocotaligo with a delegation that consisted of Samuel Warner and William Bray, sent by the Board of Commissioners. They were joined by Thomas Naimi and John Wright, two of the most important people of South Carolina's Indian trading system, and two others, Seymour Burroughs and an unknown South Carolinian, also joined, took place April 14th, 1715, the day before Good Friday. The men spoke to an assembly of Yamasee. They promised to make special efforts to redress Yamasee grievances, and they said that Governor Craven was on the way to the village. Well, all that night, while the South Carolinians slept, the Yamasee debated about what to do. And there were some who were not fully pledged to war, but in the end, the choice was made, and after applying war paint, they woke the Carolinians and attacked them. Two of the six men escaped. Samuel Burroughs fled, and though shot twice, raised an alarm at Port Royal settlements. Yamasee killed Naimi, Wright, Warner, and Bray. The unknown South Carolinian hid in the swamp, from which he witnessed the ritual death by torture of Naimi. I'm sorry, N-A-I-R-N-E, Narni. Events of that, the early hours of Good Friday, marked the beginning of the Yamasee War. So the Yamasee attacked, and South Carolina counterattacked, and 1736, foundation of the short-lived Kingdom of Corsica. 1738, Circe, an Italian opera by George Frederick Handel, that receives its premiere performance in London. 1755, Samuel Johnson's A Dictionary of the English Language is published in London. 1817, Thomas Hopkins Gavelier and Laurent Clerc found the American School for the Deaf, then called the Connecticut Asylum for the Education and Instruction of Deaf and Dumb People. First American school for deaf students. It was founded in Hartford, Connecticut. 1861, President Lincoln calls for 75,000 volunteers to quell the insurrection that soon became the American Civil War. 1865, President Lincoln dies after being shot the previous evening by John Wilkes Booth. 3 hours later, Vice President Andrew Johnson sworn in as president. 1892, the General Electric Company is formed. 1896, closing ceremony of the Games of the First Olympiad in Athens, Greece, took place on this date. 1900, Philippine-American War. Filipino guerrillas launched a surprise attack on U.S. infantry and began a four-day siege of Cartagena in the Philippines. 1912, the British passenger liner RMS Titanic sinks in the North Atlantic at 2:20 a.m., 2 hours and 40 minutes after they hit an iceberg. Of the 2,224 passengers and crew on board, only 710 survived. 1922 security guards are murdered during a robbery in South Braintree, Massachusetts. Anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti would be convicted of and executed for the crime, though there was a lot of controversy. 1922, U.S. Senator John B. Kendrick of Wyoming introduces a resolution calling for an investigation of a secret land deal that led to the discovery of the Teapot Dome scandal. Now, the Teapot Dome scandal was a bribery scandal involving the administration of President Warren G. Harding from 1921 to 23. Secretary of the Interior Albert Bacon Fall had leased Navy petroleum reserves at Teapot Dome in Wyoming as well as two locations in California to private oil companies at very low rates without any competitive bidding. Leases were the subject of an investigation by Senator Thomas Walsh. And convicted of accepting bribes from the oil companies, Fall became the first presidential cabinet member to go to prison. But nobody was convicted of paying the bribes. Before the Watergate scandal, Teapot Dome was regarded as the greatest, most sensational scandal in the history of American politics. And it permanently damaged the reputation of Harding administration, already hurt by its handling of the Great Railroad Strike of 1922. And Harding's 1922 veto of the bonus bill. Congress subsequently passed permanent legislation granting itself subpoena power over tax records of any U.S. citizen, regardless of position. And these laws are considered to have empowered Congress generally to many of the excesses it has been guilty of. 1923, insulin becomes generally available for use by people with diabetes. And you know, dogs can get diabetes, and they take something called Vetsulin. 1923, racially motivated Nihon Shogakukan fire lit by serial arsonists killed 10 children in Sacramento, California. Now, for those that are not familiar with this particular fire, the Nihon Shogakukan, it's translated as the Japanese Mission School Fire. It started April 15, 1923, at the dormitory of a Buddhist boarding school for students of Japanese ancestry. Fortunato Valencia Padilla, a Mexican-American itinerant from the Rio Grande Valley, admitted to committing the arson after his arrest in July of 1923. And he confessed to at least 25 other fires in California, 13 of which are committed against Japanese household and Japanese-owned properties. He was indicted on first-degree murder charges for the school fire on September 1, 1923. In Sacramento, with the prosecution seeking capital punishment, he was found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment. He was incarcerated at Folsom State Prison and later San Quentin. He died in 1970. In 1936, first day of the Arab Revolt in Mandatory Palestine. 1941, in the Belfast Blitz, 200 bombers of the German Luftwaffe attacked Belfast, killed 1,000 people, at least. 1942, the George Cross is awarded to the island fortress of Malta by King George VI. 1945, Bergen-Belsen concentration camp is liberated. 1947, Jackie Robinson debuts for the Brooklyn Dodgers, breaking baseball's color line. 1952, the first flight of the Boeing B-52 Stratofortress. And there's still some of those used today. 1955, McDonald's restaurant dates its founding to the opening of a franchise restaurant by Ray Kroc in Des Plaines, Illinois. 1960, at Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina, Ella Baker leads a conference that results in the creation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, one of the principal organizations of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. 1969, the EC-121 shoot-down incident. North Korea shoots down a United States Navy aircraft over the Sea of Japan, killed all 31 people on board. 1970, during the Cambodian Civil War, a massacre of the Vietnamese minority results in 800 bodies flowing down the Mekong River into South Vietnam. 1986, United States launches Operation El Dorado Canyon, its bombing raids against Libyan targets in a response to a discotheque bombing in West Germany that killed two U.S. servicemen. 1989, Hillsborough disaster. A human crush occurs at Hillsborough Stadium, home of Sheffield Wednesday, in the FA Cup semifinal, resulting in the death of 97 Liverpool fans. 1989, upon Hu Yobang's death, the Tiananmen Square protest in 1989 begins in China. Now, Hu Yobang was a Chinese politician that was a high-ranking official of the People's Republic of China, held the top office of the Chinese Communist Party from 81 to 87. He was chairman from 81 to 82 and the general secretary from 82 to 87. And after the Cultural Revolution, which ended in 76, he rose to prominence as a close ally of Deng Xiaoping, who was the paramount leader of China at the time. Well, the Tiananmen Square protest in 89 could easily have led to a full-blown revolution, but it was stopped. 1994, Marrakesh Agreement related to the foundation of the World Trade Organization is adopted. 2002, Air China Flight 129 crashes on approach to Gimhae International Airport in Busan, South Korea, killed 129 people. 2013, A wave of bombings across Iraq kills at least 75 people. 2014, in the worst massacre of the South Sudanese Civil War, at least 200 civilians are gunned down after seeking refuge in houses of worship as well as hospitals. 2019, a cathedral of Notre Dame de Paris, France, is seriously damaged by a large fire. 2021, a mass shooting occurs at FedEx ground facility in Indianapolis, Indiana, killed 9 and injured 7 others. You know, the sad thing is, whatever may be the reason, indiscriminate shooting is damn hard to justify. And if you want to claim that it was a suicide bomber, it was somebody who had psychological problems. Our government's reaction, under this administration especially, is to try to ban guns instead of dealing with the root issue. Because let's say the entire country disarmed tomorrow. You'd have, within 30 days, you'd have a dictator sitting in the White House. The only thing that keeps this country on a somewhat in the even keel is the fact that most people are armed. Now, we've been talking about the ghost of Las Vegas. And I've published 60 books about unsolved mysteries, lost treasures, and ghosts. And one of my favorite is the ghost of Texas. Now, Texas is the home to a number of very baffling mysteries. Humans developed only in the last 4 to 6 million years, and this corresponds to our scientific knowledge today. But how do you explain giant human footprints that were found in the bed of the Biloxi River in Texas? There have been many finds in the past 200 years that don't match any known pattern. In Oklahoma, an iron cup was discovered in an ancient lump of charcoal rock. These bone fragments were found in Colombia, come from a rock plate that's more than 100 million years old. Are they human fingers? They appear to be. And how do fossilized fingers from the state of Texas fit into our view of the world? And who cultivated the fruit, the remnants of which have been found in an Ecuadorian monastery 100 million years ago? Well, these are just some of the questions raised by little discussed discoveries. You know, with all the attention paid to Homeland Security, it might come as a shock to many to know that enough arms and ammunition to outfit a World War II era division to bury just north of Paris, Texas. Now, this story began in 1940, when the war clouds were becoming very clear to almost everybody that cared to follow the international news. Three Paris businessmen, Jim Cavanis, Pat Macy, and R. Walter Wortham, came up with a plan to convince the Army to establish a military base in Lamar County, Texas. And there's no question that a military base would be a boon to the economic future of Paris, Texas. After a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiation and, I'm sure, a few bribes, things began to look up for the establishment of a base, but it would take time to convince the powers that be that it needed to be established. Well, while the negotiations were going on, came the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and America went to war. January 20th, 1942, was announced in the Paris News that the War Department would build a major military base in Lamar County. Military facility eventually constructed, actually covered 70,000 acres. Camp Maxey, named after Confederate General Sam Bell Maxey, was to become one of the largest wartime facilities in the continental United States. Now, due to its size and very versatile nature of this large facility, it was decided to also make a perfect prisoner of war facility for captured German soldiers. So in 1943, the first German soldiers were processed into the facility. Eventually, over 75,000 captured Axis soldiers were sent to Camp Maxey in Texas, and An additional 5,000 were sent to Camp Maxey to sit out the remainder of the war. Now, in addition to the POW camp established at Camp Maxey, the post also was used for the activation of new divisions to be sent to the war zone. And one of these was the 49th Armored Division. Originally, one of the Phantom Divisions attached to General Patton's forces that the Germans believed were to invade Europe, but it was decided to actually bring this division to life for the planned invasion of the Japanese homeland. Now, beginning in February 1945, train road after train road of equipment began to arrive at Camp Maxey to be used to equip the thousands of soldiers soon to arrive to become part of the newly formed 49th Armored Division. And in addition to tanks and jeeps and half-tracks and personnel carriers and field artillery pieces, heavily loaded supply trains also came in containing tens of thousands of M1 rifles, Browning automatic rifles, pistols, Thompson submachine guns, hand grenades, bayonets, bazookas, mortars, radios, and a small amount of ammunition to be used for each weapon. Well, by the middle of the summer of 1945, the first of the soldiers assigned to this new division began to arrive at the camp. It's anticipated the division to be at full strength by late March of 46. But before that could happen, the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan and the war ended. The 49th Division never had the opportunity to actually get into combat. Well, the end of a major war, such as World War II, created almost as many new problems as did the entry of the country into the war. Now, the government was faced with disposing of a mountain of military hardware for which it had absolutely no use. If it simply dumped all the tens of thousands of serviceable weapons and cars and trucks on the market, the prices would drop to very low levels, and companies that made weapons and cars and trucks wouldn't be able to compete. A lot would be forced to close their doors. And this was a problem for which a solution had to be found before the country was drowned in a sea of military equipment. Well, it was finally decided to dispose of the equipment by simply leaving many military cars and trucks in Europe to be used by the post-war administration as a replacement for equipment lost by the Allies. In actuality, this became a taxpayer-sponsored giveaway of tens of thousands of new and used cars and trucks to whoever could get them. When it finally reached the point where the Allies couldn't take any more surplus U.S. military equipment, a tremendous number of cars and trucks and tanks and cannons and other assorted armaments were loaded onto ships, taken out to sea, and dumped in the ocean. But this didn't deal with the problem of the mountains of munitions stored at stateside bases that couldn't be hauled out to sea and dumped. In case of Camp Maxey, in mid-September 1945, camp officials and the Paris, Texas Chamber of Commerce were notified the camp would be deactivated October 1, 1945. U.S. Army Surplus Administration moved quickly to dismantle the camp. But something had to be done with the mountains of munitions that had been shipped there for the 49th Armored Division. After some long and serious thought, and I'm sure some other bribes being paid, long trenches were dug in a Texas prairie, and these munitions were simply dumped in the holes and buried. Also into the ground went hundreds of tanks and artillery field pieces and cars and trucks, as well as tens of thousands of new military weapons carefully packed in cosmoline. And to this day, these weapons have never been found, although there have been stories of hunters seeing the fronts of Sherman tanks sticking out of stream beds and a number of small arms being found. So where are the weapons of the 49th Division? Maybe some lucky treasure hunter will use his metal detector to find the tank of his dreams. Of course, only time will tell. Well, from Paris, Texas, let's go to Weatherford, Texas. Peaceful community known for its rich texture of folklore and a long history of slightly differing accounts of a mysterious creature that haunts Lake Weatherford. Long been stories about the Weatherford monster, but it's been hard to get a good description of this creature since even most eyewitnesses tend to disagree over what type of creature they've seen.
Few of the reported accounts say the beast is a Bigfoot, a hairy missing link ape man, mainly seen in the northwestern United States. But there are several accounts of the Lake Weatherford beast that would cast doubt on it being a Bigfoot. For one thing, the Lake Weatherford monster is mainly said to walk on all fours. Few people even said this creature is mainly hairless and resembles nothing more than a giant armadillo. But the most popular accounts report the beast as being a huge bull with red glowing eyes, and in at least two cases, it was said that he had flames coming out of his nostrils. Unlike some similar legendary creatures such as Loch Ness Monster and the Yeti, there are no huge scientific research projects trying to prove or disprove the existence of the Lake Weatherford Monster. As of now, it's primarily a local legend, a monster that brings more laughs than it does fear. Sightings of the Weatherford Monster originate with the Indians who roamed that area, which now makes up the community of Parker County. Their legend told of a fire-breathing bull that terrorized villages and killed several warriors until one young brave managed to stop the beast by piercing his heart with an arrow. During the early summer of 1953, Texas was facing a horrible drought. Mayor of Weatherford, Jim Wright, a man who later became Speaker of the House of the United States Congress, helped negotiate the purchase of a small lake which was owned by the Texas Pacific Railroad. The lake was located in the northwest quadrant of Weatherford. The plan was to expand the small lake and turn it into a permanent water supply for the community. Well, after the area was cleared of underbrush, sightings of the monster started to increase. However, a number of early accounts seem to be related to heavy alcohol use. At least that was the accusation by some officials. No real investigation was launched to explore these early claims. Early 1970s, a couple of local monster hunters provided the world with a plaster cast of what they claimed to be the tracks of the Lake Weatherford Monster. Odd thing about these footprints proved to be the lack of a front right side track, leading many of those associated with the hunt to refer to the monster as Southpaw or Lefty. Men claimed the monster's front paw must have been torn off from its arm, leaving only a stump, which it probably drug along the road as it traveled. As for the plaster cast and remaining limbs, they were reported to resemble a giant crocodile's foot. Needless to say, crocodiles are somewhat rare in this part of the world. Plaster cast of these tracks was immediately met with cynical criticism and denounced as a hoax. That is officialdom's initial reaction to anything they don't understand or can't control. Well, reports of this phantom beast continued to increase. But it wasn't until January 16th, 2000, a local news media decided to admit that something strange might exist when the Weatherford Democrat ran a small article on page 6A of their Sunday edition detailing the reports that were flooding in about the Lake Weatherford Monster. I mean, this article alone seemed to give the local myth of the Devil Water Cow, as it was called, a new amount of respect. You know, there's been a lot of stories and rumors that spring up every time there's a major news report. In this particular case, and I only heard about it when I started researching the history and mystery of the Lone Star State, which you can get on Amazon. You know, there was actually a story that Lincoln faked his death. He didn't want to go through the battle of a divorce with his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, who by all accounts was not totally well-wrapped. And then he was tired from the stress of the Civil War. And this is a seldom-told story that purported that Abraham Lincoln faked his own death and fled to Waterford, Texas. That's a strange story, no question about it, but the older generation of Parker County citizens swears it's the truth. Now, Weatherford, Texas, as I said earlier, is a small community located a few miles west of Fort Worth, Texas. And it's a place known for its long history of folklore and mythology. And among the stranger tales to come out of this area is a legend about the United States President Abraham Lincoln. Now, the belief is Lincoln faked his death in 1865 in order to start a simple life away from politics and his whack job of a wife. Although this story flies in the face of established history, hear it out before you decide that it's a hoax. Now, the story that most of us have been taught is that President Lincoln was assassinated by an actor named John Wilkes Booth shortly after the Civil War had ended. Official record says Lincoln died on the morning of April 15, 1865. Hearst carried his body back to the White House about 9 in the morning. Cavalry provided an escort to the procession, which moved up 10th Street to G Street and slowly over to the White House. Temporary coffin of Abraham Lincoln was covered by an American flag, and at the White House, the body of the president was placed in the guest room, which was on the second floor. Now, according to the story, there were 9 men present for the autopsy. Surgeon General Dr. Joseph Barnes, Lincoln family physician Dr. Robert King Stone, Dr. Charles Sabin Taft, Assistant Surgeon General Dr. Charles H. Crane, Army Assistant Surgeon William Mara Knotson, General Rucker, the Army's Quartermaster Department. Now, why he would be there is anybody's guess. He was a friend of Lincoln. Orville H. Browning, Army Assistant Surgeon. He's a pathologist. J. Janvier Woodward, an Army Assistant Surgeon, also a pathologist. Edward Curtis. Lincoln's widow, Mary Todd Lincoln, sent a messenger to request a lock of hair from the president's head. It was thought she needed proof it was actually her husband. Autopsy itself was done by Dr. Curtis and Dr. Woodward. Now, keep in mind, once the autopsy was over, the body, such as it was not seen again. Now, some classrooms in Weatherford, Texas tell a different story. A lot of local historians claim the body examined by those men was not that of Abraham Lincoln. Their problem with the official record of the Lincoln autopsy comes in the form of a man named Alexander Billy Bob Hamilton, who lived in Weatherford from 1865 to 1881. There's one known photo of Alexander Hamilton, taken in the spring of 1869 in Weatherford, Texas. And he is the spitting image of Abraham Lincoln. Now, this strange theory comes out of Parker County, and it says that Alexander Hamilton was, in fact, President Abraham Lincoln. And like many men whose wife had become a royal pain, he wanted a divorce, but because he saw no way for a man of his public stature to end his marriage, he decided, using the assassination as cover, to fake his own death and flee to Texas. Well, according to the story, he changed his name to Alexander Hamilton, took a job at a feed store. Clues to his true identity are said to include his love of quoting from the Gettysburg Address. I mean, after all, he did write it. His hat, which was a stovepipe hat, went around telling everybody he was really President Lincoln. He was sorry about that little war. Well, now the question becomes, was Billy Bob, Alexander Billy Bob Hamilton, that is, just an ordinary man who had an uncanny resemblance to Lincoln? Did he decide to use this resemblance as a prank on the citizens of Weatherford? Maybe to the full extent of quoting lines from the Gettysburg Address? Would such a man then go as far as to claim he was Abraham Lincoln? That would certainly be the logical conclusion, but in Weatherford, things aren't always logical. The real controversy began several years after he died when a young C.L. Lennon first heard about the story. He was a failed Baptist preacher, and he was intrigued by the tale and set out to learn more about it. He had a glimmering of an idea there might be a conspiracy worth repeating. Well, he devoted several hours a day to his research, interviewing members of the Parker County community as well as attempting three trips to Washington, D.C. and trying to find answers to the situation, which he found so perplexing. After committing a number of years to the study of this little chapter of history, he planned to publish his notes in book form so the public would have a greater understanding. But his manuscripts were rejected by every publishing house and editor he contacted. Well, frustrated and heartbroken, he decided he would use his own money to publish the book himself. But he was a man of limited funds, so he decided to organize a number of tent revival meetings around the Parker County area as a way to raise the money he needed. Crowds that attended these revivals retreated to his sermons about the conspiracy and how no God-fearing man or woman would ever trust the, or should ever trust the federal government. Well, all his efforts ended up in tragedy. Shortly after the first pressing of his book began, a fire destroyed the subsidized publisher's printing press, along with Lennon's original manuscript and most of his research notes. Shortly after that, Lennon himself disappeared, along with some people believing the government kidnapped and murdered him because he was too close to the truth. Others simply think Lennon skipped the country with the money he had earned from his heated government blasting revivals. There are rumors that a handful of books survived the fire, but no one has shown any proof of it. And talking about the Lincoln assassination, there's also another story that John Wilkes Booth escaped. Now, there seems to be something that attracts men with unusual pasts to come to the state of Texas. Most historians tend to agree that Abraham Lincoln's assassin, John Wilkes Booth, died in Garrett's barn, April 26, 1865. But there are a number of troubling factors tied to the autopsy and burial of Booth that lead a few people to actually claim that Booth really didn't die that night. The theory is that Booth managed to escape, and the man who was shot in the barn was somebody other than the president's assassin. And when government officials discovered they'd killed the wrong man, they decided to cover up the truth and avoid the embarrassment of a controversy. Now, when the trial of the other conspirators ended, most of the rumors about Booth escaping punishment began to settle down. Well, if in fact Booth didn't die as history reports, then maybe Lincoln did not die at Fort Sirta either. Supporting the theory he was attempting to obtain a poor man's divorce and escape from the pressures of the war, there are a number of stories that Mrs. Lincoln was insanely jealous and a constant source of embarrassment to the president. There was a vast conspiracy that allowed the president to escape. It certainly was a successful conspiracy. Around the spring of 1898, several newspapers started to promulgate the story that John Wilkes Booth escaped from Garrett's burning barn in 1865 and fled to South America. 1903, a man named David E. George died in Erid, Oklahoma, leaving a deathbed confession he was in fact John Wilkes Booth. And this was soon the topic of discussion around town. January 22nd, 1903, Enid Wave, which was the newspaper, had the following article banked with headlines, "Was it Booth?" The impression growing from evidence, circumstance, or otherwise, that the supposed remains of David George are none other than the remains of John Wilkes Booth. Well, from the first, the Wave hadn't believed that it was probable that David George was John Wilkes Booth, the assassin of President Lincoln. But it was, of course, possible. The evidence of Ms. Harper wasn't as to the fact George confessed to her he was none other than Booth in connection with the striking likeness of the assassin, the general demeanor of the man in producing parts of Shakespeare's plays and songs around saloons led to a possibility that he might be Booth. Most remarkable circumstance surrounding the dead man was the fact his right leg was broken just above the ankle. Besides these links was the fact that Booth was born in 1839 and was 26 years of age when the assassination took place, and 63 years old in 1902, if living, which was the exact age of George, according to the papers he left behind. And one thing is certain, the remains now lying embalmed in the Penniman Undertaking Room shouldn't be buried under the identity until the identity is made more clear. Remains of David George's body were mummified and kept on display at the Undertaker's for many months. Shortly thereafter, Finnis Bates, a Memphis lawyer, bought the mummy and began presenting it to the circus sideshow circuit. Such was the beginnings of a second career for John Wilkes Booth. Did Booth escape? I've heard those stories as far back as I can remember. Well, in addition to Abraham Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth, Texas also is known for having Bigfoot. There are a number of people who seriously believe Texas has its own resident creatures referred to as Bigfoot. Bobby Hamilton hunts the hairy beast that he swears haunted him as a kid. He's one of the most intrepid Bigfoot hunters in the state. He was a former professional wrestler, lives in a double-wide trailer with his wife and four kids on 20 acres of woodland outside Warren, Texas, about 125 miles northeast of Houston. And he's obsessed with the hairy, stinky creatures he says he's seen on four occasions or frequently heard crying out each other in on his property. Saw his first Bigfoot, he said, when he was only five. Tells of it appearing at the window of his bedroom and motioning with his fingers for him to come out and join it. His two older brothers confirm there were similar encounters. According to Hamilton, I think he may have been looking for an easy meal and thought he could catch a child. Or maybe it was a female Bigfoot who had lost its own baby. Was trying to take a human away to replace it. He said, I had no idea what I was seeing, but I thought it was the devil. Within a year, Bigfoot had driven Hamilton's family from its deep woods homestead in Nacogdoches County. Unknown animal killed his pet calf. Monstrous screams in the night and loud banging on the house terrified his mother and aunt. Family's perfectly good horse went crazy. Hamilton believes he went crazy from terror and could no longer be ridden. He said his father was working offshore and his mother called and told him he better come move us out of here or she's going to do it herself. So in actuality, Bigfoot ran him away from their home. He took to sleeping with a sharp hunting knife in his hand and a tomahawk under his pillow and the baseball bat by his side. In fact, it was so bad his mother would wake him up by calling out from the bedroom door because she was afraid if she approached him, he'd attack. He said, I wanted to keep my gun by my bed, but my parents wouldn't let me. At the time, Hamilton had no idea what he had seen motioning to him through the window. And East Texas backwoods are full of tales of monsters and demons and haints. Now he's convinced he saw nothing more mysterious than a primate, a gorilla-like creature, just unrecognized and unclassified by science, but that a handful of scientists are sure exist. Renowned primate expert Jane Goodall said September 27, 2002, in an interview with National Public Radio, she's certain Bigfoot exists and is excited by the prospect that hair said to have come from a Bigfoot came back from DNA testing as belonging to an unknown species. She said Hamilton said there's a lot of weird beliefs about Bigfoot, and I don't hold with none of them. In from outer space, in the shapeshifter, he's certainly ain't going to come in the house, sit on your lazy boy, and eat microwave popcorn and watch Perry Mason with you. It's a wild animal. So how could a large, hairy, smelly ape live for years undiscovered in the forests of East Texas? Though seldom far from a farm, a trailer, or a man on horseback, parts of the woods are covered in brambles and vines and swampland that protects it even from experienced backwoodsmen like Hamilton. But this is where Bigfoot lives. Hamilton's convinced, sometimes ranging into more populated areas as close to Houston as Conroe to find food. And tales abound in East Texas of a so-called wild man or monkey man who's tall and hairy like a ape and roams the swamplands. Hamilton wonders why a stream in Cherokee County where a number of Bigfoot sightings have taken place was named Monkey Creek. He's certain it's because many years of reclusive primates remained hidden along its banks. But when Hamilton was 8, he saw a book on Bigfoot at a little country store and came to the conclusion his family had been driven away from its home not by a monster but by a wild animal. He said, "I knew then and there I was going to devote my life to hunting Bigfoot." As a teenage boy, his interest strayed to easier excitements. Professional wrestling circuit later diverted him. He flashed his smile weekly on Dallas TV. He was a wrestler, sported neon duds and shoulder-length Mel Gibson-style hair. 1988, he started a construction company. He said, "I had enough money where I could do anything I wanted to, so I started hunting Bigfoot." He said, since put tens of thousands of dollars into the search, buying fancy cameras and infrared lights and high-powered pickups and guns that can kill a rhinoceros with one shot. And he does admit he's afraid of Bigfoot. He said, "If he were at the end of the road, he'd be over here and have you before you could say, 'Don't do it to me, darling.' They can run biped or quadruped. They're about 8 feet tall and they kill the deer by breaking their backs with their bare hands." Well, while on a research trip, Hamilton makes sure Bigfoot knows he's there by urinating around the edges of his campground, being sure to pee on trees that will hold the smell. He says he's really trying to piss off Bigfoot. He says, "I'm saying I'm the alpha male here." And almost invariably, this works. Bigfoot comes out of the woods and howls and screams and tears branches off trees and throws things at the tent. He says, "After a while, I say, 'This is enough of this,' and I go outside and confront him." He said, "I can hear him howling in the trees, but they don't show their faces." Well, once when he ran into a Bigfoot just over the Louisiana line, he said he was terrified as it had a horrible stench, a smell Hamilton believes to be related to scents frightened gorillas emit as territorial warnings. He said, "I dropped my video camera, ran to the truck, and came back with a shotgun, a rifle, and a pistol. All the hairs on my body were standing up. I was nauseated for hours afterwards. Definitely was trying to send me a message." Well, you know, interest in Bigfoot is increasing with the rise of the internet, according to Hamilton. He emails believers as far away as Australia, where Bigfoot are known as Yowies. After experiencing frustration with some of the other internet Bigfoot groups, he bought a book and taught himself HTML. Started his own site, the Gulf Coast Bigfoot Research Organization, in 1998. He posts sightings and hosts forums and leads camping trips into Bigfoot country. Members boast that they're willing to take polygraph tests regarding their sightings. Despite their insistence Bigfoot exists, there may be another explanation for some of the howling heard by him. Could be coming from skeptical locals. Jesse Wolf, chief deputy of Tyler County Sheriff's Department in Woodville, was asked about the authenticity of the claims made by Hamilton and his followers. He responded, "The only Bigfoot around here is the one you're talking to." Wolf was a former football player for the Miami Dolphins. He's 6'8" and wears a size 17 shoe. He said, "I was born in 52, and that's about the time he comes around. If people have seen Bigfoot prints in their yard, it's probably me. Only difference is Bigfoot ain't wearing Nikes." Bigfoot hunters have had to face even more ridicule than usual since the December 2002 death of logger and Bigfoot hoaxer Ray Wallace in Seattle. When he died, his sons revealed he'd been playing pranks about Bigfoot since 1958, making tracks with giant car feet, filming himself in the gorilla suit, and cutting a record of Bigfoot sounds. He went offered to sell the Bigfoot to Texas millionaire Tom Slick and had to back out when Slick made a serious offer. The announcement that Bigfoot was dead led to anger and disbelief among many who had grown up watching movies like The Legend of Boggy Creek. Los Angeles songwriter Danny Freyard never had a Bigfoot encounter, responded to a bluesy swamp-like song called Bigfoot Blues that begins with, "When I was still believing Bigfoot, don't care what they say, still believe in apple pie and the good old USA. Now they claim it was a hoax by a wise old fool. Those 16-inch footprints are carved with a iron tool, but we all saw the movie of Bigfoot Mama strutting, walking past the camera just like Dolly Parton. Well, if it was a hoax, I want my $5 back. I swear at night in the woods I've heard that Bigfoot holler." Freyer said it'd be sad if Bigfoot was nothing more than a hoax. He said, "It's one of our American myths. I don't want to see it die out." Hamilton's faith was unshaken by the disclosures about Wallace. He said, I know it wasn't Ray Wallace hoaxing around our homestead back in 1969. Some guy shows up prancing around in a gorilla suit in these parts. He's going to have a hole put through him sooner rather than later. And Hamilton, of course, believes that scientists will step in after men like him have taken the risk. He said, some guy in a white lab coat ain't going to be the one to find Bigfoot. It's going to be guys like me that knows the woods. I'm going to be the one to prove it. I have to touch one. I have to run my hand through its fur and touch its leathery face. So the question becomes, is Bigfoot real or not? Well, Texas has a lot of stories, some bizarre, some not. Almost as many mysteries underground as there are above ground. Long been stories about races living in caves. The Indians who roamed the Texas prairies had many stories about these creatures. Well, we're going to talk about reports of ancient subterranean excavations, the very reality of which presupposed the existence of a scientifically advanced race that reigned thousands of years ago. Excavations have apparently been constructed before the flood, and in some cases after it. First account I'm going to talk about actually appeared in the October 1947 issue of Amazing Stories. Now, that was supposedly a science fact magazine. I talked to one of the people involved in the creation of the original stories about the underground civilization with the Darrows and the Taros and all these. And there was a man named Norman Finley. Had an experience that was rather unusual. He and a couple of other folks went hunting down in the Big Bend area. And there's a no more wild or desolate area in the country than the Big Bend. Rugged, mountainous, cut by canyons. There are innumerable parts of which had never been set, man had never set foot on them. It was one of the most desirable areas that Findlay and his companions found themselves. Now, driven about 90 miles southwest of Marathon, Texas, that's a little town of about 700 people at the foot of the Del Norte Mountains. And after they got to the parking area at the foot of the Del Norte Mountains, about 4,000 feet up, they then gone on foot. Dirt road petered out, and they couldn't get the car any further. They were hunting deer, but wasn't having any luck. Just as they were about to call it a day, Findlay spotted a mountain lion. He snapped a shot at it and knocked it down, but the mountain lion just rolled over to his feet and started to make tracks elsewhere. Findlay and the other followed him, and since it was obvious he was wounded, not making very good time, managed to keep him in sight for about a mile, and sure they had him when he ran into a box canyon. Well, the lion started up a faint trail on one side of the mountain to a small cave they could see about 100 feet from the floor of the canyon. They followed him up the trail, and when they got up to the cave, there was no lion. The cave was one of those dished-out affairs that was so common in the Southwest. It rolled out of the face of a cliff, and it was cup-shaped. Only access to it was by that trail, but it was a strange little cave. It had a sand floor and was just about big enough to park 20 cars in it. On the cliff edge was a low stone wall. And that in itself was not too unusual because such caves have sheltered Indians for thousands of years. But the thing that did make it unusual is in the rear of it was a perfectly round hole. And it was clear that the lion had ducked into this hole. Well, they approached it rather cautiously and threw some rocks into it to see if they could stir him up, but didn't get any response. They could hear the stones rolling and bouncing down an incline, and the sound just got fainter and fainter until it died away altogether. Well, they approached the hole and peered down into it, and it was perfectly round, about 4 or 5 feet in diameter. And they couldn't see very far down it, but it appeared to descend rather sharply and at a steady gradient. So they gathered some dry grass from the canyon floor and made some torches. Now, the incline of the bore was too steep for them to climb down, so they tossed the torches in. They just slid further and further down and vanished into the gloom. They never did see or hear from the lion again. First thought they'd stumbled into some old Spanish mine workings, but no sign anywhere of a dump that always goes with a mine. And by all rights, there should have been some sign of the earth and rock that had come out of that hole, but there wasn't. Well, they inspected the hole itself more closely and were amazed at its symmetry and the consistency of the section of the bore as far as they could see down it. And the fact that the bore was perfectly round puzzled them. If it was a mine shaft, it would certainly have been round, but instead would have been flat on the bottom. The fact the shaft extended straight and unwavering as a rigid pipe was cause for further amazement. And since the fellows didn't have any rope with them, which they would have needed to descend the shaft, or any lights for that matter, they'd have scratched their head and left. Well, Findlay wanted to go back with equipment and see how far down the shaft went and what was at the bottom of it. But, you know, ranchers are busy people. And he never went back. And in the meantime, he got pretty broken up when a horse he threw him. And in fact, he's in such bad shape. He lives in Fort Worth, has somebody else run the ranch. And they all talked idly about having a look at the cave someday. He says he knows exactly where it is and could find the box canyon with his eyes shut. You know, keep in mind that things like this relate somewhat to what used to be referred to as a Shaver mystery. And I met one of the people involved in the Shaver mystery. And there's no question that there's a whole lot more beneath our feet than we understand. Well, on that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll talk some more about the history and mystery of the Lone Star State. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.